messages from New Life Gillette series, Parenting 101. This week, Pastor Mike presents part 4 of this series.
Well, good morning. Man, I'm happy to be with you guys this morning. We are in the last week of a series called Parenting 101, and we're kind of applying parenting principles to everybody. So whether you're a parent or not, I think you'll get something out of the service today. I'll say welcome to those of you who are watching online, to the guys over at the prison, and to those of you who are here in this room. It's that time of year again. It's November. It comes around and they expect us that we got to pick a side, right? We got to pick one side or the other side, and we're supposed to be passionate about it. That's right, I'm talking about we have to choose between turkey or ham every year. And there's some crazy people who pick ham. It blows my mind. No, the reality is, in a group this size, there's probably 500 people in this room. And how polls work is you ask a smaller group that represents a larger group, and we know polls always work really well, if what they think on a topic, and then you can kind of guess what the larger population thinks about that topic. So we're going to do some practicing on this conversation real quick. So if you had to pick between Coke or Pepsi, and you got to pick one or the other. You can't be like,
water, because I'm healthy.
One or the other. Coke or Pepsi. Okay, so raise your hand if you would rather Coke. Okay. Pepsi. Wow. That's mind-boggling. I'm no Pepsi fan, but Coke lost. First service, I think Coke won, so I don't even know what that means. I was going to say that tells us Gillette likes Pepsi, but why did first service? I don't know. Doesn't work. Polls are broken. Let's do a different one. If you had to pick between McDonald's or Burger King, you had to pick. Taco Bell's not an option. McDonald's or Burger King? McDonald's, raise your hand. Okay. Burger King. Oh, McDonald's blew it away. McDonald's, it's those fries, right? Can't get enough of them. About cats and dogs. Oh. We're passionate about this conversation. Cats? Keep them up. Look at those people. You now know way more about those people than you did before. Dogs? Okay, all right, yeah. This is the one where I'm tempted to say none of the above, but that's not allowed. So we're a dog population, apparently. Dog people. What about basketball or football? Basketball? No? Football? Okay, all right, go Chiefs. Yeah. All right. Well, we can do these, and some of these are not really that emotional. Apparently, the cats and dogs ones is, but most of these are not emotional questions. But you can get emotional pretty quickly when you ask people to pick sides, right? Like if I did Republican or Democrat, I'm not going to do it. But if I did Republican or Democrat, then some people would get emotional. Either you get emotional about the fact that I'm a huge fan of one, or I'm a huge fan of the other. Or you get emotional because it drives you crazy that somebody's a huge fan or a huge fan of the other. If I ask you Donald Trump or Hillary, you would get passionate about, you're not supposed to say. You would get passionate about one or the other, right? Or you would become passionate about the conversation because it drives you crazy that the other side came to the conclusion, a different conclusion than you did. And this is the reality of the world we live in right now. It drives us crazy that people come to different conclusions having the same information, the same facts that we have, and they come to conclusions on really important topics. They come to a different conclusion than we do. And we're just left thinking, what is wrong with you? Seriously? How can you think that? How could you possibly come to that conclusion? And so as a result, we assign motives, right? If somebody comes to a conclusion that we disagree with or we can't understand, we immediately assume there must be something wrong with them. They must have evil motivation. They must have ill will towards the opposite side because they don't really think that. They're just coming to that conclusion to get us, right? So we assign bad motives to the people that come to conclusions that we don't because we can't understand why they come to their those conclusions. And eventually, when we argue about these things and we're arguing Democrat or Republican, then we eventually throw our hands up and we say, let's just agree to disagree. We're not going to agree. Let's just agree to disagree. But we hate that. Don't you? I hate agree to disagree. Usually for me, it's like agree to disagree, but you're wrong. I'm right. And there's certain conversations where I'm just like, there is no way. I cannot possibly comprehend how people can come to the conclusions they come to. Like on the conversation, is there a God? Like, it is emotionally mind-boggling to me to think that somebody can have the same evidence I have, see the same unbelievable reality of the nature of the world that we live in, and come to the conclusion that there's no God. Like, I've studied the same science that you have. I've studied this, and you seriously can't see that there's a bigger picture in this? I can't comprehend it. Why? Why are people able to come to conclusions with the same facts? How can they come to conclusions different than we come to? Let me tell you how. They see the world differently than you do. If they come to a different conclusion with the same facts, it's because they see the world differently than you do. Or they have what we call a different worldview than you do. And worldview is a hard one. You can't just say, well, you're from Portland, so you must have a liberal worldview and you'll come to these conclusions. Or you're from Gillette, you have a conservative worldview, you'll come to these conclusions or whatever it is. It's not that cut and dry. Like, worldview is way more complex than just labeling an issue. Worldview is developed by everything about you. You have your specific world, and nobody's worldview is the same. There are no two people with the same worldview. And you have the worldview that you have because of your DNA, because of the family you were born into, because of your experiences, because of your talents and your abilities, because of the things that have happened to you. All kinds of things have combined to develop within you a worldview which makes you see things the way you see things. And now you're wondering, why are we talking about this? This is a parenting series. Well, as parents, we will never be there with our children as they come to all the conclusions that they're going to come to. As parents, you are not going to be able to spend your life next to your child or your grown child and say, now choose this, now choose this, now come to that conclusion, now have this opinion. It doesn't work that way. So what do we do? What do we do as parents to help our children come to wise conclusions? We teach them how to have a healthy, godly worldview. How does that happen? Well, central to Christianity is this idea of renewing your mind. It comes from a few different passages in Scripture, but the most famous one of them is something that Paul wrote to the church in Rome. He said this, "Do not conform to the pattern of this world." In other words, the world has a specific way of seeing things, a specific way of doing things. Don't conform to their pattern. But be transformed by the renewing or by the changing of your mind. Be transformed by the change. Make your mind, make your worldview a healthy worldview is what it's saying. Then, once that happens, you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good, pleasing, and perfect will. If you can see things the way God sees things, then you will be able to adopt His worldview, and we will understand why He asks us to do what He asks us to do. Because renewing your mind is learning to see the world the way God sees the world. So when He asks us to do something, it makes more sense. God created this world we live in, and He created it specifically, like got really detailed. And he created the world, and then He said, and now here is how that world was designed to be lived in. Here are some things you should do in order to live in this world the way I created it to be lived in. So when we see that world the way God sees the world, then living the way he told us to live just makes sense. He doesn't have to give me specific instructions on every single thing. I don't have to go back to him and ask him specific instructions on every decision I make, because when I see the world as God sees the world, I will make decisions. I will naturally make decisions that reflect his will. Andy Stanley says it this way: when we see as God sees, we will be more inclined to do as God says. And this is the difference between the world naturally teaches people and the way God teaches people. When pastors or teachers instruct people on how to live their lives, it comes across usually like this: do as I say. Do this, do this, do this. Take this step, then take this step, and take this step. And if you line up all the things that I'm saying, if you take all the steps that I'm saying to do, then I will approve of the way you're living your life. But this is a very weak way of teaching. It's a very temporary, short-term way of teaching to just follow somebody's instructions. Because eventually the teacher's not going to be around to help us follow or do what they're not going to be around to tell us what we should do in a specific circumstance. So if all you've done is taught do as I say, they're in trouble. There's nothing lasting about that. So when you look at the way Jesus taught, it looked a lot more like see as I see. This is why Jesus taught in parables and stories. He didn't say, do step one, do step two, do step three. He said, this is what the world is like. This is what the kingdom of God is like. And he helped us to get a picture of what it looked like to live in the world so that we could see as he sees. Then you will make wise choices. Because if you see as God sees, then you'll actually end up doing as God says. This idea applies to parenting similarly. When children see as their parents see, this is the reason why God described himself as our father. When children see as their parents see, they will be more inclined to do as their parents say. Let's talk about one of the most common phrases in parenting. Because I said so. Right? You should do X, Y, and Z. Why, Mom? Because I said so, is our common phrase in parenting, right? And that's okay. Children should be taught to do whatever their parents say, but that's kind of like saying, do as I say, right? Because I said so is just follow instructions, just fall in line, right? But we can take this to the next step and not just stop at because I said so. Here is why I say so. Because if you can see the bigger picture, if you can understand why me telling you to do this is actually in your best interest, then you are helping them to see as you see. Because those of us who have grown up in the church and those of us who have spent a lot of time discovering what it is that God tells us to do and beginning to see as he sees, gaining the wisdom of God, most of us would love to pass that wisdom on to our children. We would love for our children to begin to see as we see, not because we want them to follow us because we're some kind of lord or champion over them, but because we believe that the things that we've discovered and the way we see is because of our understanding of God and who he is. So how do we pass this wisdom on to our children? Well, I'll tell you how we do it by telling you how we don't do it. What we do not do is tell our children to figure it out on their own, right? Don't tell your kids, go find yourself. Go discover who you are. This is the world's message of, you are a unique person and you need to go and find yourself, they say to teenagers. Now, hold on a second. And teens, if you'll allow me, I'd like to pick on you for a second. This is the reality of your brain at this moment. There is something going on in your brain in the development process and in the growth process, like physiologically, you are a little brain damaged right now. And because of that brain damage, it's not your fault. We all went through it. Because of this problem, you have a hard time delaying gratification. You have a hard time doing hard things now so that they pay off later. You have a hard time being patient right? That's just the nature of being a teenager. Now, most of us, we hope that we mature past this problem. We grow out of this problem. But this is why when you're a teenager, if you really want to live a wise life, then you'll do what God told us to do, and you will honor your father and your mother. And you will honor them, not just because the Bible tells you to do so, but you will honor them because they're not brain damaged anymore. They've been where you've been. They understand things better than you do. I don't care if you think that the world has changed and it's a different world than when you grew up. It doesn't matter. They have learned more. They are wiser than you are. So we don't tell you, go find yourself. Because we know you're going to find the wrong person. What we say is, let me tell you who you are. You are a child of God. You were created by the Almighty, infinite God, and He created you for a purpose. And let me tell you what your purpose is, because it's written out for us, and I've studied it. Let me tell you about it. You are called to be a disciple of God. So we don't trust our teens to find who they are. We don't trust our children to discover who they are, because they're not ready yet. I've been reading one of those kid Bibles to my son. It's one of those that kind of makes the story not quite so gruesome in some areas and makes it a little easier to understand. I've been reading these stories, and we've gotten through quite a bit of the Bible. And so the other day, I asked my two-year-old son, I said, so who's your favorite character so far in the Bible? He said, the snake. Pastor Mike's son, favorite character in the Bible is Satan. Son, go discover who you are. Follow your instincts. No! Let me tell you who you are. The snake is the enemy. You are following the wrong guy. And we are in our wisdom. Our goal is to pass on this wisdom to our children in such a way that they make decisions based on good information, based on seeing the world as God sees the world, and help them become who they were created to be. Okay, so as a parent, I only have a two-year-old son. I've got another one on the way, but I only have a two-year-old son. As a parent who has very little actual experience doing these things, instead of giving you a list of do's in parenting, what I would like to do is help us to discover a C's. Discover some things that will help us to see our children as God sees us. And to do that, I want to give a list of things that I want for my children. And it's a little weird because I'm about to preach a message about things I want, but I think they're sacrificial wants, so I think it's okay. So this is just a list of things that I want for my children. And I think in some way they reflect what God wants for us. So I think it can be revealing. One thing that I want for my children. I want my kids to be accountable to God, not to me. What does that mean? I think for me, apart from my parents living what they preached, I think this is the most powerful thing that helped me in my childhood, in my development, in understanding the wisdom of my parents. It's when one day my mom sat me down and she said, Mike, you are no longer accountable to me. You are now accountable to God. And as a 16-year-old kid, I remember the exact moment it happened. I can tell you where I was sitting. I can tell you what happened because chills ran down my spine. Because my parents had taught me enough to understand what it meant to be accountable to God. God's standard is crazy high. Now, they had also given me an understanding of grace and an understanding of how God is on our side in this conversation. But at the same time, I was just like, it's just easier. You just tell me. My response to mom was like, no. That's too complicated. You're playing mind games on me. Just tell me yes and no. That's way easier. But why did my mom do this? Why did my dad do this? It's because they wanted me to learn how to be accountable to God while they were still around to help me when I fall. When I screw up, when I make bad decisions, they were there to help me learn from them, to help me grow in these circumstances. I'm like, Mom, no, just tell me what I shouldn't do, no. I'll give you an example. One time I went to my mom not too long after this conversation happened, and I said, Mom and Dad, is it okay if I buy this stereo? It is an awesome stereo. I mean, it holds three CDs, at the same time, mind you, and two cassette tapes. I don't know, that's like 10,000 hours of music or something. I need this crazy expensive stereo, mom and dad. You know what their response was? Ask God about it. You think you should buy it or not? Now, I should not have bought this stereo. I was a poor 16-year-old kid who was dumb enough to have a car payment at 16 years old. Like, I didn't know better. But they said, ask God about it. So I'm like, all right. God, should I buy the stereo? Nothing? All right, I'm buying it. Moving on. And I bought the stereo. I actually still have the stereo to this day. It's in my garage. I think it still has a Petra Praise cassette tape and a Michael Jackson cassette tape in it to this day. Because I don't know how many times I listened to it, but those were the ones I listened to when I listened to it. Because it had two cassettes. I needed it. So a key to this strategy of allowing your children to be accountable to God at a certain point when they've gained a certain amount of maturity and growth, a key to this is failure. The actual goal of the strategy is that at some point they do fail. So that when they fail, you can help them to learn from their failure. You can help them to grow and mature. You've probably heard about helicopter parenting, right? I saw a lot of eye rolls when I said that. Helicopter parenting, it's people who parent two hands-on, right? They're too involved in making every decision for their kid. One of the jobs I had before I worked here was that I was a men's resident director. That's the person that like takes that has to communicate to parents on behalf of kids and stuff. And there's RAs, resident assistants underneath me, and they dealt with the kids, and I dealt with the parents. By far, I was an RA before. I wanted to deal with kids again so bad because their parents made the job so hard. Why? Because the parents I was dealing with were the helicopter parents. These are the ones that you knew these people when you were a teenager. Their parents took their side over everybody else. It didn't matter what authority. If they were getting in trouble at school, they would go down to school and they would fight on behalf of their kids. And the teacher is wrong. The resident director is wrong. Everybody's wrong. My kid is always right. You know these people. They're called helicopter parents. And the reality is my generation is taking this to a whole new level. I think we should quit calling it helicopter parenting and call it drone parenting. Because that sounds more millennial. And drone parenting is way easier than helicopter parenting, right? Now we can watch their every move from afar. We can keep tabs on them no matter where they are. We make them turn on Find Your Friends on their iPhones so you can tell where they are every second of the day. You're tracking your kids on Snapchat. If your kid has Snapchat and you didn't know you could track them on Snapchat, you're welcome. You can track them on Snapchat. Because we want to know where they are. Don't get me wrong. I am not saying that you should not know where your kids are at all times. That's okay. But there's a point at which we go too far with this. There's a point at which we want to be so involved in every decision they make, every step they take. I think that's a song. And we want to be so involved in their lives that we end up pushing them away. We're chasing after them, trying to make their decisions for them, and they're running away from us. It's not healthy. This can be taken too far. When I was a teenager, my parents had no clue where I was. Most of the time, they should have. But they didn't. And mom would sit awake every night on the couch waiting for us to get home because they didn't know where we were. There's a healthy medium there, but we got to be balanced because we don't want to scare them away. Which brings me to number two. I want my kids to want to be my friend when they're adults. I want my kids to want to be my friend when they're adults. So how do we do this? We formulate a strategy that ensures that someday they want to be our friends and they respect us at the same time. That's a hard thing to accomplish. That both they want to be our friends and they respect us at the same time. It's very difficult and it requires a strategy. It requires us to be slow to speak, like Paul was talking about last week, and quick to listen, to not discipline out of anger, to not discipline because a specific behavior annoys us or we want to make sure that they didn't end up like we end up or don't struggle with the things we struggled with, all the while reminding ourselves that the things we struggle with is what helped us to learn the most in our lives. What are the motivations of our discipline? So I've done some research and some reading on this topic, and most of the psychologists and professionals in this conversation divide parenting into stages. And everybody's stages kind of look a little bit different, so I've kind of changed them a little bit to come up with what I think is a common understanding of what parenting looks like in stages. And the first stage is what? 1-year-old to 5-year-old is the discipline years. This is where you're just laying down the law in love, but just always laying down the law. You're teaching them right from wrong. Don't pee your pants. Don't eat the Legos. Don't take off your clothes in public. Just common sense stuff all the time, but you're step by step saying yes, no, discipline years. Not too long ago, we were in Colorado with my family, and my twin brother has young children too, and we were all standing in a circle trying to decide what we were going to eat. And so we're out on this, the middle of this shopping center area, and we're all talking. And then my brother looks down and realizes my nephew is standing in the middle of the circle, pants to the ankles, peeing on the middle of the sidewalk. And luckily, we had formed like a hedge of protection around him so the rest of the world couldn't see. This teaching moment, we're in stage one. Discipline years, we teach you. You don't pull down your pants and pee on the sidewalk in the middle of a shopping area. Step one. What's the stage number two? Ages 5 to 12. These are the training years. This is also a hands-on stage, but the training wheels have kind of come off. What does that mean? That means that you kind of expect some common sense. You expect them, just because I haven't told you you cannot do something, we expect you to have an understanding that you should not do that thing because it's just common sense. And they're being held accountable for even things that you didn't tell them specifically. Step number three is age 12 to 18. These are the coaching years. This is a more hands-off teaching. You don't know every single little detail of their life. You don't know every single decision they're making, everything they eat, or everywhere they're going. You're kind of slowly allowing them to have some freedoms, right? This is the stage in which my mom said, you're now accountable to God. Why? To give me some more freedom so I can make some mistakes and learn from them, so that we can get to the last stage, and that's the friendship years. And this doesn't mean that you're not teaching them anymore, but it means that you're teaching them when they're asking to be taught, right? And sometimes there's some correction and some interruption and stuff that happens in life, but generally, you're just kind of helping them when they want to be helped. I thought it was funny that as I was reading about these stages, that nobody includes a stage before one. So I want to add it if I can. I want to add stage number one, 0 to 1, survival years. This is when you're not doing much, but trying to survive, right? You're trying to survive. You're trying to keep them alive. Food in, food out. Just keep them alive. They're like an Etch-a-Sketch that you shake up every day and it just restarts. Don't shake your kid. That's not what I meant. But it's just kind of like, it's a fluid process. Never mind. And the reality is, these stages don't apply to everybody. There are kids that kind of go, the different ages happen and different orders happen based on your specific situation. But this just kind of gives general guidelines because it's important that you have a strategy. And that strategy has to involve doing hard things now. Like right now, there is a worn out spot in our kitchen corner from where my kid sits in timeout 90 hours a day. We're in the discipline years. I feel like this is all we do is discipline over and over again, but it's helpful to me. It's encouraging to me to know that this stage has an end and that if I do this stage well, it will pay off later. This is what we do. We delay gratification because we believe it'll pay off later. Because when Lincoln, my son, is 5 and 6 and 7 years old, I can still outrun him, right? If we're in public and he starts running away from me when I'm telling him to do something, I can just chase him and grab him and hold him in my arms and force him to stay there. And then I go on with my business, right? But what happens when I have not that's the because I said so parenting, right? But if you want to see as I see parenting, then I catch Lincoln. That's a good first step. And then I teach him or I discipline him. This is why we don't run away from dad. And there's some punishment that goes along with this. Because by the time, if you don't do this well, by the time they're 12 and 13 or 14 and they can outrun you depending on your current physique, whatever age it is, then if you haven't done well the early stage of discipline, then you're in trouble when they can outrun you. Then you're helpless. And you're trying to play catch up. And when you're playing catch up as a parent, they start to realize you're out of control. And then there's this tension thing happening and fighting happening. It just doesn't work. You can't skip a step to jump ahead to the friendship years. And you have to dedicate yourself to a step while you're in it. Make it inconvenient on purpose. It has to be inconvenient to you. Good parenting is inconvenient because we delay gratification because we know it will pay off later. My parents taught me, and my parents have now 5 children, and every single one of them are friends with their parents. Because my parents, they didn't do everything right. In reading these parenting books, I could critique the heck out of my parents' parenting. But they did some things really well. And following these stages is one of them. This is one thing that makes divorce parenting really hard. When you're divorced and you're trying to parent, there's this competition thing happens and you want to be the favorite and they want to be the favorite. So you're both jumping ahead to the friendship years before you should. And you're not on the same page about discipline and you're not on the same page about what stage are we in at this point. And I'm not saying it can't happen. I've seen divorced people do this really, really well. But the mom and dad in this situation both have to be on the same page about what is our strategy in this. Step number 3, or the third thing that I want for my children, is I want my kids to be the same people in private and in public. And I'm just going to hit this really quick. But why is it that we hound our kids in public? We want them to look good in public. We want them to act well in public. And we teach them, we do this and we don't do this. We look like this. We don't look like this. These are the habits we do because we want them to have a good persona. And we really hound them on who their friends are, right? We want to know who are you with because we don't trust the people they're with. We trust them a lot. We don't trust the people they're with. Which sometimes I think, and all that's good, but what about when they're in private? What are we doing to ensure that we are parenting our child and teaching our children about what they do in private? Our children are right now, a lot of them, are walking around with supercomputers in their pockets. They can talk to anybody in the world at any time. They can do anything they want to, Google anything they want to, find out any information they want to. What are we doing about this? What is our strategy? Should you have been trusted with a supercomputer in your pocket at all times when you were a junior high? No way you should have been trusted with that. No way you should have been given that much freedom. And we keep track of them and tabs on them about everywhere they go and everybody they hang out with, but we give them unlimited access to something that could destroy them, that can take them down paths in their life that will have very long-term ramifications if we're not careful about this. I'd like to take a minute, if I can, just to recommend something to you. There are awesome programs out there that can help you keep your children accountable when they're in private, especially if they have smart devices. The first one is one I've used since I was in college. It's called Covenant Eyes. Sometimes it's a little inconvenient. It's blocking sites that I want to go to, but it's blocking. It says I shouldn't because of how it's rated. But it's way better than some other ones I looked at. So I highly recommend that if your children have smart devices, they should have Covenant Eyes on their devices. It tracks where they go and sends you a report, and it also blocks sites that they shouldn't be going to. And while we're on it, this is not just for our kids. I think every one of us should have this on our phones. I've had this on my phone. My wife gets a report every single week of every single site I go to, on my phone, on my computer, on my iPad, all of them. It goes straight to her and she gets a notification about every single site I went to. We need to be accountable when we're in private. Another one is one called Circle. Disney released this. You connect it to your home router and it's limited to your home surfing. But if your kids just have a computer, this will work fine. If they just have a computer in the house that doesn't access data, they can do it this way as well. Paul just signed us up for a church account on the covenant eyes. If you want to use covenant eyes, Paul has signed us up. If you go to this site, you will get a $4 a month discount for covenant eyes. I think it's $11 for a family plan or something like that. You get $4 off if you sign up using our login. We don't get anything out of that. But if you want a discount on your covenant eyes, you can do it that way. But we have to have a plan for how we are making sure that our children are learning how to act in private. And finally, the last one I'm going to say is this. I want my kids to marry someone like their mom. Aww. Mike, you're so romantic. No, the decision that they are going to make about who they're going to marry is one of the most important decisions your kids and my kids will ever make. Picking a spouse. So how are we being strategic about teaching them who to pick? Who should we say yes to, and how does this unequally yoked thing work, and how do you know who is worth dating and who's not? Those conversations are incredibly important. Proverbs says, the man who finds a good wife finds a treasure, and he receives favor from the Lord. The same is true about husbands. I have to teach my child so that he will end up marrying a woman who sees the world, not just someone who makes good decisions or had good parenting, but somebody who sees the world as God sees the world. Every single night, I pray for my son's future wife. And that's weird. But that's because this girl, she may be alive or maybe not born yet because he's young enough, whatever. I pray for her so that when she marries my son, when she becomes one with my son, that she will help him to even better see as God sees. I think it's incredibly important.
Thanks for tuning in to New Life Gillette. For more information, visit us on the web at www.newlifegillette.com. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And always remember, Jesus loves you very much, and he died to give you new life.